currently in the midst of. Basically, it's my contention that our social theory surrounding the concepts of both crime and punishment is lacking. In other words, we want to understand what are, on the one hand, causes and contributors to criminal behavior. In particular, we want to understand what criminal behavior means. Is it purely a social convention? Is there a logic to what should or should not be criminal? And then given a context of criminality, what sorts of institutions, what sorts of social phenomenon, what sort of exogenous factors contribute to criminal trends? And then in conjunction with that, how is it that we understand the processes of punishing criminal behaviors as a social concept? What causes punishment rates to increase or decrease? What causes different nations to adopt the techniques of punishment that they choose and practice? Now, there are a variety of sort of competing perspectives or different schools of thought and different social science traditions that try to respond to these questions. And basically, the state of a lot of those literatures as of today is that, well, both of these things are very complicated, and there isn't any particularly good universal theory or framework which encapsulates all of the facts of crime and punishment, so to speak. In addition to that, I came about this topic explicitly from an Austrian / classical liberal political economy perspective. So in reading all of those literatures, it definitely seems that Austrian perspectives are underappreciated and capable of providing the sort of consistent and applicable framework that accommodates for a lot of the loose ends, so to speak, the existing puzzles in the disciplines, as well as does it account for things that the other sort of perspectives that are available haven't really addressed. So in a large sense, lots of economists have looked at crime. And in doing so, have tended to explicitly focus on the concept of the deterrent effects of punishment and crime as a rational behavior. Now, basically, what I think is the major sort of problem on the side of economists is that they don't necessarily recognize the context of economic science as a broader social science. Austrians have this unique recognition of praxeology. Austrians recognize that human action in general is our object of inquiry, and that the basic science of economics, that people behave according to incentives, that people choose things according to their subjective preferences, really allows for a broader realm of applying economic science. So what I try to tell my students is, well, you know, economics isn't just about yield curves and interest rates and mortgage markets and business cycles, but it actually applies to all facets of human and social behavior. And so I think that the stakes are sort of high when you're asking questions about things that are not conventionally economic, so like sort of violent interaction and conflict resolution, as we're going to talk about over the course of this class, and then sort of the formal institutional responses to it, the criminal justice system and incarceration. This topic, too, can be assessed with economics, and Austrians are sort of ripe for that role. The first lecture, tonight's lecture, I'm calling it The Facts. It's not particularly theory heaven. What I'm trying to do is begin with the sheer facts of our criminal justice system to make sure that all of us in this course start off on the same page as to what is the conditions and realities of the criminal justice system with relation to incarceration in the United States today. And in doing this, we'll sort of give context to what are the major questions and puzzles and research topics for the discipline of criminal justice scholars today. Now, in doing so, what we can do, or the standard that we should, what I'm trying to accomplish by making sure that everyone understands all of the sort of what I'm calling the stylized facts. You can't see my bunny ears on the camera. That's weird. The stylized facts of crime and punishment. Why am I using this phrase, stylized facts? Well, stylized facts is a catchphrase that macroeconomists like to use. And it's a standard by which they judge and assess the predictability and the accuracy of macroeconomic models. So what I explain to my students in macroeconomics is that if you have any theory of the macroeconomy, Keynes has a circular flow understanding, as well as the ISLM framework, monetarist sort of tweak, the elasticities of that framework. Austrians have, I guess the closest compatibility would be Garrison's three-graph relationship between the loanable funds market and the capital structure. All of these are just sort of different models, how it is that the economy operates and distributes things like capital, interest rates. It's a series of relationships between those variables. Now, if you're going to have a model of the macroeconomy, it needs to be able to account for the stylized facts of macroeconomics. And there's three major sort of components of the stylized facts of macroeconomics that everyone should A, be aware of, and everyone should B, recognize as the challenge for any macro model to explain. The first is the general accumulation of wealth over time. In other words, we're, as a society, very, very rich compared to yesterday. Massive population increases, massive accumulations of capital have occurred since the Industrial Revolution. If you're going to have a macro theory, it has to sort of explain the process and contributions of growth. Secondly, you need to explain the variance of wealth around countries. So just as Adam Smith titled his sort of magnum opus, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, the entire discipline of economic science has been intimately concerned with this question ever since. And if you're going to have a growth theory, then the growth theory needs to be able to account for why some countries are growing at different rates than others, and why some countries have accumulated different amounts of capital and populations than other countries have. And the last stylized fact is cyclical booms and busts. So within any given country or across countries, when you have a surge or a glut of capital stocks or wealth, business openings and closings, et cetera, you need to explain that as well. So to some extent, pointing to the other two components are oftentimes very good challenges to an overly narrow, a too narrowly focused macro model. Like if you're just concerned about wealth creation and you come up with sort of a solo growth model, for example, where capital flows to the area that it has its highest marginal return, you're leaving open this notion of why is it that we're not going to get capital distributions across countries, even when, according to the theory, it would imply that you could get a higher rate of return on your capital by sending it abroad. So in the solo growth model, for example, predicts convergence at the international level, and yet we don't necessarily see that across the wide sample of nations. So that's an example whereby the national variance is used as a criticism of, say, a purely growth-oriented model. So there are similarly stylized facts of crime and punishment today. And so what I'm concerned with is everybody knowing at least what those are to assess our theories of crime and punishment as we move forward. So first and foremost, that's not how you change slides. First and foremost is just the sheer net amount of individuals sort of included or affected, we could say, by the criminal justice system. Now, this is a lowball estimate if we were going to use a broad notion of the word affected, because victims aren't included in this, criminals who aren't arrested aren't included in this, as well as just, I mean, any sort of ordinary person who isn't necessarily directly criminal or indirectly within the criminal justice system. We could also say that they experience some sort of social difference by living in one criminal justice system rather than another. These numbers, I think, require a bit of explanation, especially in light of a lot of the commentary and press that has occurred recently. So the first point that I would mention is people should understand what these labels are referring to. Now, all of the charts and statistics that I'm going to put up in these slides, they're all freely available on the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So first and foremost, let's say from the get-go, these are not sort of graphs or statistics taken by just activist or watchdog websites or organizations. These are official statistics calculated and calibrated by the United States government and the Department of Justice, released by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. They have a series of annual publications. They're all freely accessible online. Some of them are in your course readings, but the website's pretty accessible. You can pretty much pull down these things over the course of a few minutes with some clicks and points. So what are we looking at here? Well, first, what we should recognizes this distinction between, say, community supervision and incarcerated. Now, this term incarcerated is being dissected into two categories, jail and prison. Now, the difference is the role that the facility plays in the criminal justice process. What does that mean? Well, a jail is basically where you go when you get arrested on the street. If you were to walk outside your home imbibing in drugs and a police officer noticed you, you would get arrested. Directly from there, you would go to a jail. Drunk driving, violent altercations, whenever people initially get arrested, they go to a jail, a holding facility. It's relatively temporary. It's temporary until the time when you can either post bond in order to be released, or in circumstances where bonds are not allowed, you await your trial, your arraignment, your sentencing. Prison, on the other hand, is the facility that administers your actual penalty, your sentence, after you've been sentenced. 5, 10, 15, 20 years in prison, you are sent to a prison facility. So that's sort of the distinction that we're working with here. So some people wouldn't apply incarcerated as broadly between this distinction. But again, this is where these sort of like stylized facts issues come into play, is because if you want to make any international comparisons of the American criminal justice system, you have to ask yourself, well, okay, so we have this process where there's different jails than there are prisons. Is that how other countries do it? Because it's a not insignificant number of people who are in the process of jail. So secondly, I mean, even within the United States, we have some states do it differently than others. So, for example, Virginia doesn't have state penitentiaries, state prisons. They have a series of more larger scale jails. So when you get arrested on the street, so to speak, you're in the same facility as someone who's been sentenced for several years. There's literatures that talk about the pros and cons of each system. The logic in the Virginia system was in large part about the ease of tracking inmates and keeping them in their closer to their local communities. Sometimes at the state level, different facilities will trade prisoners. If you have certain prisoners are not getting along, for example, part of their sentence will be converted to another facility, and so they get transported. This is actually, on the one hand, it's a point of activism for a lot of folks who recognize the link between recidivism and maintaining your family network while you're incarcerated. So lots of people are concerned about when you get an inmate who's relocated halfway across the state, how difficult it is for their loved ones to go visit them, and that has a really bad effect on their likelihood for going back to jail after they're released. And secondly, in some states, it has significantly upheld the process or opportunity for not just private policing, but not just private prisons, but private policing more generally. So, in other words, some states have it on their legal system that it's against the law for anyone to have someone under bondage, handcuffed or tied up, for example, while they have a firearm. So in those states, private police forces or security officers don't carry guns. They carry like flashlights. They can call the legitimate police, but they can't carry firearms. Well, that basically means that private contracting is nearly ineffective not an opportunity, not even a viable alternative in those states, so long as you have to transport inmates. New Jersey's case like that. So the second distinction that's important to remember here is this difference between probation and parole. Now, parole is a process of being released from prison, whereby you were sentenced to say 20 years as a consequence of your good behavior and complying with the rules of the facility. You go up for periodic hearings to see whether or not your behavioral risk to the facility, if you need to be increased in sentence or decreased. Remaining years of your sentence can be converted into parole sentences, whereby you're released, you have to meet with an officer periodically. There's a variety of efforts to sort of try to place you with employment opportunities, monitor living conditions, so on and so forth. Probation, on the other hand, is designed as an alternative to criminal sentencing by incarceration. What that means is that when you get convicted of the crime, instead of going to jail, the judge sentences you with a certain time period of probation, which is in structure and in real terms very, very similar to what someone on parole experiences, but the person on parole went to jail and now on parole, and the person on probation sort of got probationary status in lieu of incarceration. So a lot of people sort of cite these magnitudes. So for example, the major one that's of recognition is this 2,284,900. Total number of people in some form of a box, sort of 2009, there's over 2 million people in the United States are in box. That's the number that's typically used to construct our 1 in 100 per capita rate. Then you'll hear a variety of sort of other statistical comparisons, like more people are involved in the criminal justice system than slavery before 1850, more people involved in the criminal justice system than populate Los Angeles and Miami combined. That number is usually referring to total correctional population, this 7,225,800. Now, the last sort of breakdown that I would mention here as well is that these numbers are combined state and federal prisons. So the jail and prison distinction is not just local versus regional or national or something. Jails are relatively local. It's your police precinct and your city hall probably has a jail in conjunction to it. But your prison is usually administered by your state government, state penitentiary, for example. But then included in these numbers are federal prisons, which is sort of a unique thing. Not as many countries have as many federal prisons as we do. And as of 2008, sort of the closest year comparison to these figures, approximately 178,530 inmates were held in federal facilities. So again, it's a not insignificant number. Now, federal prisons look differently than state prisons, in large part because of the demographic makeup or the criminal makeup of their populations. Predominantly, federal prisons are populated by international, because you have to break a federal crime to get a federal trial. So it's usually major drug trafficking across international lines, as well as immigration issues. So some people sort of discount and or have a hard time looking at these numbers in any sense of concern. Because, for example, so 1% of the population is incarcerated, according to the 2 million estimate on the right. Well, 1% doesn't seem that much. I mean, 1 out of every 100. So I know 100 people. To think that one of them has had would represent someone incarcerated. I mean, any sort of degree of social filtering or social sorting, you would easily sort of recognize that, like, no one in your life or social circle has necessarily been to jail. So it's very difficult to recognize how closely or proximate that statistic is. But one of the biggest cases, I think, for using the larger number estimates, or to recognize at least that our per capita rate is a lower bound estimate of the influence of the incarceration trend in the United States, is the fact that, well, on the one hand, all of these parole and probation numbers, the fact that there is a degree of growth, more people go on probation and parole today than they did yesterday, this matters a bit. In large part, it matters because because once you are arrested and tried, the likelihood of you being incarcerated and convicted has significantly changed. So Alfred Bloomstein and Alan Beck write in 1999, they noticed that the rate of arrests, your likelihood of being caught doing a crime, that's stayed relatively constant, not significant shocks up or down since the 1980s. It still hovers around 50% And a lot of economists have emphasized this low amount because it affects the rational economic model of crime. If you have little to no chance of ever being caught, it really doesn't matter nearly as much how severe your penalty is, right? If we're going to fine you $1 million, but there's only a 1% chance that you get caught doing it, increasing it from $1 million to $2 million doesn't dissuade you nearly as much as increasing the likelihood of you actually getting caught. So the likelihood of getting caught committing the crime is about, has remained relatively constant, about 50%. In addition to that, average prison sentence hasn't necessarily changed that much since the 1980s. There are a significant rise of things like mandatory minimums, three strikes you're outlaws. They're isolated to certain states. Those states do have larger incarcerated populations than others. But what Bloomstein and Beck really argue is the major thrust of the difference is the likelihood of conviction and the likelihood of being sentenced to death. So roughly in, say, 1980, probation cases and sort of as a proxy for those number of people who are getting arrested, it changes from being 13 out of 100 people who get sort of arrested and tried get a criminal sentence. By the time we hit 1999, it's 28%. So the number of criminals that we're sending to jail, or the number of people who are being found guilty and sent to jail, has doubled. And then some, in a relatively short period of time. Next, if furthermore, what we should really recognize is that, going back just a second, if we take, if we really wanted to sort of take the highest estimate of people who have at some point been sort of found guilty of a crime and put into some punitive apparatus of the criminal justice system, we would take this sort of larger 7,225,000. Now, if you average that, or not average, but divide that by the adult population, right? Because these are all sort of above 18-year-olds, with sort of rare exceptions of juveniles being tried as adults, which is insignificant compared to the 7 million number. You get a much higher ratio than the 1 out of 100. It's much closer to 1 out of 35. And I think that that's a ratio that a lot more people can wrap their head around and think in terms of, how does this actually affect me or the people that I interact with? I mean, instead of saying, okay, do you know anyone who's in jail? Do you know anyone who has some sort of criminal record? Do you know anyone who has had some sort of arrest or criminal trial associated with them? That number gets closer to one in every 35. And that's at like the broadest average level. So again, we're not separating for wealth or geographic location or race or age or any of those things. We'll get to those. Looking at this next slide, again, sort of tracks the growth in each of these areas in particular. What's most noticeable in this graph is the huge magnitude of increase surrounding probation. Now, some might look at this optimistically if you have sort of a negative view of incarceration more practically, because lots of countries, for example, when looking at America's massive amount of incarceration, have recommended, and so have the United, so have interstates within the United States, recommended that probation be comparably as effective a criminal justice strategy, that we should use it more often relative to incarceration. But in short, what I think the statistical reality of our use of probation is much more like is that we use it as a complement rather than a substitute to incarceration. It's a substitute, but only for political interests, not necessarily for criminal or citizen interests. In other words, whereas he could conceive of a judge saying, I'm going to give this criminal probation instead of incarceration because I think it's a more appropriate sentence to his crime, and so on and so forth. But I think that what this growth in this period of time represents in conjunction with the growth in the imprisonment rate during that time is not necessarily that judges are trying to utilize the leniencies that are made accessible to them, but are rather constrained by scarce incarceration resources and forced to use parole when there are no jail cells sort of remaining. In other words, what these facts are already sort of starting to allude to is what I would argue is incarceration excess. It's very difficult whenever you're talking about a social phenomenon or any sort of procedural outcome to gauge objectively how much is too much. An argument about excessive incarceration implies or invokes an obvious economic response compared to what? So person A says, there's too many people in jail in the United States. Well, economist's response is naturally going to be compared to what? And I think that economists have actually had a very difficult time recognizing that these are not efficient or optimal or equilibrium trends in the criminal justice system, but they are instead very inefficient and excessive trends that need to be accounted for. So, in other words, recognizing that the incarceration rate has nearly quintupled in the same period of time as has this probationary increase really puts this probationary increase in context. It's not necessarily indicative that judges are using alternative means of criminal sentencing, but rather that they're using those alternatives because they've run out. And in large part, like state population trends of their local incarceration facilities comport this insight that California is running facilities at nearly like 200%. The facility was designed to house so many people and they sort of double it. We see that effect and correspond to those trends more closely. So I think a lot of economists might argue, maybe this is acceptable and maybe this is efficient relative to our crime rate. Okay, so what we've been looking at up until now is trends since, say, the 1980s. And in conjunction with those trends of up, 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 right? So we've got more people in jail, more likely convictions, more people on parole, etc. It seems that according to that same time, our violent crime rate has declined. And a lot of people sort of look at this as an affirmation and a support for this sort of straightforward rational choice theory of crime, which states that if you increase the severity of your punishment, that you will decrease the incentive to commit crime. Now, I'm not necessarily, I definitely don't disagree with the logic of the rational choice model of crime. Yes, it is true that there should be a deterrent effect that would be measurable, and there's tremendous amounts of research to support that. What I'm more concerned with is whether the costs and consequences of increased punishment are worth the deterrent payoffs relative to alternatives. And we don't really know what those alternatives could be, any number of things. So for example, what I think sort of weakens the case in support of the particular types of policy proposals that we've had in the last 30 years that the previous graphs were pointing out, things like get tough on crime, the war on drugs, mandatory minimum sentencing, etc. One could look at those graphs and this graph and say, well, okay, more people in jail means lower violent crime. But stretching the history sample, we have to recognize that there are and have been significant declines in violent crime, relatively unrelated to increases in incarceration. So it's not to deny the existence of deterrent effects, but whether or not it's driving the bulk of the phenomenon and whether or not it's the essence or the major player in the broader framework of understanding crime and punishment, I think that case is a lot harder harder to make in light of this this longer series. This is actually like brand spanking new data. Alex Tabarrok just released a paper on it. Some of you might have seen this graph posted on Brian Kaplan's blog. Secondly, the other sort of point of fact to challenge the efficient notion of our criminal justice system driving declines in crime, this violent crime trend is in Canada. So we see a similar sort of radical downtick since the 1990s. Now, there's a ton of research just focused now on this aspect of the trend in violent crime. Everybody's sort of obsessed, like, what explains the great 1990s crime decline? The reason why everyone is so sort of particularly attentive to that topic is because it was very much out of sync with people's expectations. This guy John DiIulio wrote an article in the early 1990s, sort of it was like a plea to economists to step into the applied realm of criminal justice and start thinking creatively about how to solve what he thought would be a tremendous crime spree. I mean, it's like reading the article, it sounds like he was convinced that like the Foot Clan would have ninja squadrons sort of stealing people's purses and raping them on the street day in and day out. And the logic that motivated that fear was that criminals were younger and harsher. When you're looking at the sort of like the beginning of this peak in Canada and the United States across various different countries, the average criminal is 15 to 18, as well as sort of armed, and their rap sheet includes explicit violence. So the logic was that, well, we've got sort of career criminals, older criminals in the jails now. Then we've got the younger criminals. They're eventually going to be older. And then if we keep at this trend of growing new crops of younger, harsher criminals, then one generation away we'll have massive, massive problems. So here we are, one generation away, early 2000s, and violent crime in not only the United States, but in other countries that have not necessarily done the same sort of mass incarceration tactics as we have all enjoyed a significant decline in violence in our major cities. Now, again, just as Alex Tabarrok's graph in the previous slide alludes, well, something other than mass incarceration has to be driving the massive decline in violent crime in the 1700s, and something other than mass incarceration has to be driving that massive decline in crime in the 1800s, and so on and so forth, that it could be the case or at least it should be the case that something else has to be driving the massive decline in crime in other countries such as Canada, in this slide, Germany, England, so on. Several other OECD countries have experienced the same sort of 1990s violent crime decline as we have, yet, as this next graph shows, few to any countries incarcerate at the rate that we do. I apologize that this slide in particular is in small print. It's taken from the King's College of London has a International Center for Prison Studies, and it's sort of like their response to the Fraser Index. It's not really their response. I'm saying their version of the Fraser Index. It's a bunch of guys who sit around and they've tried very desperately to come up with a calculational formula for understanding incarceration rates across these different countries. So what this one is showing is that you have our net amount at the 2 million some odd prisoners in the United States, and that outpaces all of these other 36 countries' incarceration rates combined. Like I said, Canada, England, Germany, many of these countries have similarly enjoyed crime declines in the 1990s. You can zoom in. I can zoom in, or you can zoom in. I'm not really sure. Whoa, there we go.
But I think that's just me.
So this left column is all of these sort of amounts stacked on top of one another, and then in comparison to the United States net. And that's on the reading list as well, the latest King's College report. Now, this notion that the relationship between violent crime and punishment strategy or punishment outcomes, there's not as much of a direct link, especially when you take an international, when you take a long-term approach, when you look at the broader history of crime. Yeah, I mean, if you're truly going to understand the phenomenon of crime and response, then you should look far beyond 1960s until today. You should look as broad a historical perspective as you can. You should look at a variety of different institutional environments. Not just, say, Western advanced economies. And, I mean, this is a similar insight that, as what's coming out of some of the most sophisticated empirical research on the topic of the 1990s crime decline. So what's happened in most recent years of publication is that a lot of scholars have become very, like, narrowly focused on the 1990s, and a host of sort of explanations has come out. So a lot of people are really familiar with Stephen Levitt's work linking abortion and crime. Now, I think it's important to explain what happens in that literature. I mean, Levitt's not saying that the most significant contributor to the decline in crime was the Roe v. Wade decision. And he's not, again, denying the existence of deterrent effects. In fact, one of the most significant drivers that he finds is the increased incarceration. But what he's arguing is that abortion seems to have not an insignificant role, that he can't get rid of its statistical significance, even though it seems so antithetical or bizarrely related. Bruce Benson similarly has tracked that in the same sort of time period in the 1980s till today, you've got a massive rise in private security industry. Looking at census data, the amount of dollars that people spend to secure their own person and property has radically increased because the technological capacities to do so have also radically increased and prices have relatively declined. John Lott makes similar arguments with private gun ownership and argues that the the statistical frequency, or at least the data that we have available, is grossly underestimated because people don't necessarily report how frequently they fend off attackers by brandishing weapons. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book Tipping Point, surveys a lot of research on what's called the broken windows theory of crime. Now, the broken windows theory of crime is very different from the broken windows fallacy in economics, but basically it's the notion that crime begets crime. So if you have a neighborhood with graffiti on the wall and broken windows and litter everywhere and low lighting, that people sort of presume a tolerance and acceptance about the committing of crime. Now, when you have Gladwell sort of alludes to is the massive decline in crime in New York City, which was accomplished in large part by making progress on these sort of again ancillary margins or broken window margins. So you had subways got cleaned up and lights changed and things like that, and it led to significantly lower rates of purse snatchings, muggings, etc. And so what I think like the collective wisdom of a lot of that research is the notion that there's a myriad of facts that influence the decline of crime. And some of them seem incredibly influential given their sort of low cost. But so, I mean, if cleaning the graffiti off of a subway stops five purse snatchings and a rape, it seems like a cheaper strategy than like arming and training dozens of additional police force officers to like continuously patrol. But on the other hand, it's also nearly impossible to plan those sorts of strategies from a position of central authority. How do you foresee the next type of Roe v. Wade effect on the decline of crime? Which again, I think supports a call or a request for Austrian analysis of the crime and punishment topic, because basically what we're saying here is that crime is itself a complex social phenomenon. Now, punishment is a very sort of state-based response to a very complex social phenomenon, and so what we're looking for is institutions that reflect and complement or react to the degree of complexity of the initial sort of social problem. Now, I think it's important because of the unique, uniquely American identity of mass incarceration. It's important to look at the breakdown of our population, of our prison population, in ways that other, more so than other countries. Now, what this graph, I think, demonstrates pretty well is that the sort of early portions of the 1980s had a very particular breakdown in the types of crimes that were coming into the criminal justice system. Violent crime and property crime pretty much made up the bulk of criminal violations and then subsequently incarcerations. The sort of most significant jump in time again occurs early 1990s, late 1980s, in conjunction with the war on drugs. So not only does the drug crime significantly bump up its proportionate dominance, but it also it seems to correlate with an increased percentage of increase in the violent crime rate. I think this next graph shows better how significant the drug war has been on changing that demographic of incoming criminals. So again, 40 to 50% shared between property and violent crimes circa 1980. By the time you get to 1997, it's about a third split between drugs, violence, and property. So these are sentenced prisoners, right? In other words, the sort of static outcome that we have now is some leftover of pre-drug crime population, and now a new surge of criminal inmates, and a third of those inmates, each new batch is driven by drugs. And again, it's difficult to sort of control for how much of our violent crime rate is driven by the drug war itself. Now, aside from being what we should also add to this is that these are state prisons, okay? So again, this graph here is state prisons. So what we should add to this even is the 178,000 some odd inmates in federal prison, right? So that would be predominantly drug and immigration violations. So I guess our public, somebody asked in the chat room what a public order crime is. Public order crime is pretty much anything from public indecency, public intoxication, victimless, but not necessarily voluntary. So things like drunk driving, but not necessarily hitting anyone, is oftentimes public order violations. Basically, like anything that's considered criminal behavior that doesn't have a victim, but isn't drug crime or anything else. So whether or not they would consider immigration violations a public order crime, I'm not really sure. But what we should recognize is that adding another 178,000 people to this tips drug war up to be nearly a closer 50-50 split with violent crime. Let's keep going. So in addition to the way in which inmates are broken down by drug offense, there's a significant disparity in inmate populations along the margins of race. Now, I think, again, we can challenge a lot of conventional wisdom about the explanation for this trend. So some people have said things like, well, it's obvious that, I mean, to crudely paraphrase the perspective, some might think that this graph and the massive amount of African Americans that are incarcerated relative to white Americans reflects latent racism, reflects like a legacy of Jim Crow, so on and so forth, in the American psyche, and or explicitly within American police officers and courts and judges, etc. Now, again, I think that the context of stylized facts can challenge that perspective. Not to say, I think that the outcomes of our criminal justice system are inherently biased against blacks, and that's sort of like a tragic convenience. But I don't necessarily think that that gives us an ability to cast moral aspersion on, you know, on particular police officers or particular individuals on the margins of racism within our criminal justice system, in large part because, again, the relative disparity has grown in conjunction with the drug war. has also been shared by basically every incarceral experience that we can imagine. And so what race is really doing in these graphs, I think, is proxying for wealth. In other words, prison facilities across time, across cultures, across nations, usually have poorer citizens in it. And the two most significant margins of disproportionality in our criminal sentencing is age and wealth. So this chart breaks down our whites versus blacks versus Hispanics, but also on the margins of age. 18 to 35 are the predominant inmates. Now, again, I think that this the same sort of logic that we were talking about DiIulio being so concerned about should give some basic concern about the sustainability of our system. One of the major things driving exponentially rising costs in our system is aging inmate populations, as well as pension programs with the correctional labor force. So if you think about what is our likely future expenditures on these sorts of programs, those costs are only likely to go up. So one of the major things driving these expenditures today is the aging population. So even though our static net static net inmate population is heavily weighted toward against the young, as those younger generation individuals age and are currently serving more proportions of their sentences than inmates in the past, aging inmate populations are more expensive to deal with, in large part because of the healthcare costs. So with our sort of like advanced division of labor and strides in medical technology, inmates are living longer. And so they're more expensive to care for than the past. That more or less concludes my intention on showing the basic facts of incarceration in the United States today. I think that what we're going to be moving on in the next few weeks is contrasting and comparing what I would loosely title the economic perspective of crime, and by economic I mean more mainstream rational choice or neoclassical perspectives on the economics of crime and punishment, and then in contrast the sociological perspective, and as a shorthand for that debate, sociologists, when they look at these facts, they say this is excessive, something needs to be done, and it's a definite puzzle to explain. In contrast, economists are predominantly those individuals who are making an argument that what we have might be relatively efficient, that it could be comparable to the rates of crime that we have. In other words, as a matter of history of thought in the economics profession, one could argue that there's been an overemphasis on the beneficial effects of deterrence and an underemphasis on broader social theory, broader consistent social theory of crime and punishment. And again, I think that Austrian perspectives are well-tooled to do that, because we have this more broadly applicable praxeological framework to work with. In comparing and contrasting those perspectives, I plan to show you sort of graphically and with the relevant literature where future publication opportunities sort of exist? Like, what are the missing components of a broader Austrian social theory of crime and punishment? So sociologists are pretty much in agreement that we're in a prison crisis, that we that this phenomenon is uniquely American for some reason. Interestingly enough, like, they're pretty antagonistic about market processes being a relative solution to any of this, which I think is most disconcerting, because it's one of the sort of, again, to crudely caricature this position, it seems that a lot of people are operating under the assumption that mass incarceration is the dirty bedfellow of capitalism, and that if you're going to have a private property rights regime, that it requires this sort of heavy-handed enforcement apparatus to make it work as such. I don't think that's right. And I also think that it grossly misunderstands the political processes and the role of state financing and state social control that sits as a background story to these historical periods that have endured these sort of statistical trends. So with the remaining 25 minutes or so, what I would like to do is field questions. So I think I see anyone can sort of type into the chat box for questions. Danny Sanchez just invited everyone. I see, can you convert table 9 to rates per 100,000 right now? No, but are you referring to per 100,000 in population, in American population, or per 100,000 in prison population? Because I think if it's per 100,000 in prison population, all you would just do is sort of like truncate these numbers. But if it's per 100,000 of the general population, what you're the reason why it's probably not in that form is because the numbers would be relatively small, like super small. It's 25 to 29. Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, the sort of proverbial facts about African American bias is like, African Americans have a higher chance of going to jail than they do university, marriage, number of other sort of ideal life choices. And the white, again, the white population, it's relatively insignificant. So again, think in terms of our 1 in 100 remark seems relatively insignificant, right? If I told you 1 in 100 people had some sort of bizarre disease, I don't think it would necessarily affect the way in which you interact with that many people. If I told you 1 in 35 have some sort of broader relationship to this disease, that would become much more significant. But then when you start to recognize that, again, race is sort of a proxy for wealth, and wealth is an influence on where people live, what you're really talking about is that there are some communities in society, and people like Charles Murray, Walter Williams, various different social commentators have noticed this trend, where it's really hard to even find men between the ages of 18 and 35, in particular, urban black neighborhoods, have basically been siphoned from what would otherwise be some of the most employable individuals. Racial disparity disappears once accounting for wealth. No, not necessarily. The most recent research does allude to significant racial bias in sentencing, and that's something that plays out in tort law as well. What I'm saying is that disparity is a common trend in incarceration practices across different countries. So if you look at So for example, my paper in Ancient Greece, they talk about lower classes more populating the prison system than a sort of fair, balanced mix. If you look at other countries that don't have large populations of African Americans per se, but do have larger populations of some other form of ethnic minorities, their systems are usually comparably disproportionate. In addition to the fact that the disproportionality of our system has been around beyond the length of mass incarceration. It has exaggerated with mass incarceration, but it doesn't necessarily purely correlate with the American experience. And so I think that sort of challenges the purely discretionary view that it's endemic of or purely endemic of racial bias. Glaser and Greif have really interesting statistical work on trying to tease out that effect. And they do find, again, some significant amount of racial bias. Have you done any research on the prison population on illegal aliens jailed? I read some statistics showing illegal aliens comprising 25% of federal prisoners. Again, so federal prisoners. So federal prisoners is a much smaller sample than is these figures. These figures are predominantly state. The bulk of our incarcerated population are state inmates. Federal prisoners is only about 200,000. So 25% of that, illegal immigration. Now again, yeah, that's huge. So like what these numbers show us is how these resources, right, if incarceration is a resource of promoting social order, if incarceration is a resource of enforcing against the social consequences of crime, what these figures tell us is how that resource is being deployed. And what it's doing in the United States is predominantly being deployed against young African-American men who are drug criminals. Now, how is that resource being deployed at the federal level is predominantly 25% immigrant violators, and then the significant remainder international drugs, and sort of once you get into higher end corporate crime, it's often federal because it's involving things like international markets and insider trading rules and stuff. Also, I've seen some statistics on states like California, Texas, and New York have very high illegal alien prison populations. Have you come across anything like this? So yes, the largest stock of federal prison growth is first of all privately contracted, and second of all intentionally designed to respond to immigration. So basically, we wouldn't have nearly as many federal prisons, and it's like I said, it's obscure or bizarre that we have as many as we do relative to other countries. And the predominance of those facilities has been constructed and maintained in order by Immigration and Nationalization Services, so the INS has solicited the construction and contracting of those facilities. Some of your charts at the beginning, it looked like the rates of incarceration have been stabilizing over the past few years. Is that largely because of jails, prisons are far too crowded, or are there any other reasons you would suggest? Okay, I think that topic is also multifaceted. I think that about 5 years ago, a lot more attention started coming onto this topic. And there is a bit of sort of ideological an activist concern against mass incarceration that there wasn't, in large part because of how out of step it is with the violent crime rate. So in other words, when violent crime was high and get tough proposals were being pushed through, people said, okay, yeah, send them to jail. Now, there is still a bit of that behavioral bias, but it's to some extent mitigated. And now that crime rates are low, people start to reflect and question practices. So I don't think that that local governors and local jurisdictions can get away with continuing on the part of voter preferences. But also, and probably more significant than those issues, is that there's a real cost constraint here. Michael Tonry has a really interesting article in 1991 where he talks about sentencing reform. Now, sentencing reform is about what rubric judges are sort of given or allowed to use in order to calculate criminal sentences. And his argument is that it doesn't really matter the pseudoscience behind designing these sentencing grids and sentencing guidelines. And I mean, they're basically like throwing chicken bones. They're these bizarre, almost Leontief-style input-output models. You committed a violation for the fourth time. That's a blue crime, and blue crimes get 10 years in jail. Well, Tonry argues that the only thing that actually translates into real results for jurisdictions to lower and mitigate their excessive criminal populations is real hard budget constraints. It's like when you get a state that's strapped for cash and doesn't have the means of producing or contracting or hiring more cops or wardens or guardsmen for prison facilities, then you get judges thinking more critically about ways that they can simultaneously appear tough on crime or be concerned with their public image insofar as if they're going to let a violent criminal go on the streets, then there's a backlash if that violent criminal subsequently commits crime. So they want to avoid that, but at the same time, they don't have anywhere to sort of put them, and so they have to think more strategically about who they send to jail and who they don't. And so his argument is that it's the real economic constraint that drives any sense of sort of efficient allocation of prison space. So to some extent, in today's fiscal crisis, I think we're seeing that more pervasively, that even though these trends were up and up and up, Bob Higgs had this hilarious, well, not hilarious, but tragic description in his essay, Lock 'em Up. It's one of the chapters in his Against Leviathan text, where he says that if the rate of prison inmate growth were to continue at its sort of like 1995, 1999 trends, then by the year 2080, the incarcerated population would outpace our free population. And he jokes that we would have to reform immigration laws because we would need more staff members to staff the prisons. Now, what your observation, Matthew, is that, well, those trends haven't necessarily continued in this year or the year in the past, but one of the biggest things that's going on in today's sort of political economy discussions would be the fiscal problems that each states are facing. I mean, they just don't have the money to staff these programs, especially when a lot of these programs are filled with union employees, which commits to long-term pension programs. So I had a sort of similar reaction that maybe this problem is correcting itself. But then, I mean, I can't help but be concerned about, in light of stimulus spending, in light of sort of QE2, QE1, potentially QE3, et cetera, that like these massive amounts of expenditures will have to get spent in some sort of industry or network of interest, and so whether like perhaps all of these sort of like particular proportions could be washed in some like massive expansion depending on how those funds get allocated, and that's something that we'll talk about in future lectures a lot, because I think that one of the perspectives that comes out of like the sociological take on crime and punishment, in conjunction with this notion that while harsh penalties are the bedfellow of capitalism, is that they want to draw a hard and fast distinction between, say, the great society visions of Keynesian planning and Keynesian spending on the one hand, and then they want to accuse the sort of criminal justice system with taking from that. So as part of like a right-wing market ideological tendency in the in since the 1980s. So in other words, well, FDR had all these great visions of building schools and roads and community centers, and then Reagan comes along in the 1980s and basically like siphons that money away from those programs, but keeps that spending level in the criminal justice realm. Well, I think that that's sort of a bizarre interpretation of history. The jailhouses and the correctional facilities were part and parcel of the New Deal. The architectural designs were similar, and there's lots of historical evidence on that. Secondly, I think that it's a consequence of the partisan nature of our democratic system. It's the domestic law and order spending is a different form of interest group compared to education spending, and it has different partisan support. So I can imagine some sort of politics as exchange model whereby Democrat wants to get into office, wants to increase spending by X number of dollars. Republican says, yeah, I'll go along with that so long as that spending is on domestic law and order type services, because cops, firemen, and correctional officers vote for me relative to Democrats. So I recognizing the way in which government finance has operated in the criminal justice system, which we'll talk more about over the course of the summer, I think discounts those minor downticks that we've seen this year and last, especially in light of the fact that like it seems like we're on the brink of massive spending increases across the board. Does anyone else have more questions? Slide 5 and 6 seem to show how there is an inverse relationship between capital accumulation and violent crime. Wouldn't this explain why in the 80s, now violent crime would have seen such a drop? For example, the role cell phones, computer, internet, DNA play. Capital accumulation and violent crime, slides 5 and 6. I guess you mean as we become wealthier, we have less crime. I think that that's probably true. I think that it's also very underappreciated in criminal justice literature. Like I said, I mean, the sociological perspective is explicitly hostile to capitalism, stemming back to 1970 and reflected in today's sort of international comparative framework. The notion that access to a global economy somehow leads to increased cultures of crime, and therefore an increased criminal justice system to respond to it. I think your observation is probably more accurate, that with the wealth and resources to respond to crime, people sort of take those actions, but we mute it behind a lot of these other trends. There's another guy, Saurez, S-O-A-R-E-S. One of his essays, I believe, is in the reading for one of the later courses. But so similarly to macroeconomics, he looks at institutionally similar countries, right? So the King's College Index, somebody was asking why those numbers don't add up compared to the other ones. Well, the King's College Index has to be as objective, so they end up throwing out a lot of estimates, because if the United States has a bunch of data on probation and parolees and things like that, but another country literally just like puts people in a random cell block, then it doesn't mean much when you say that they have one incarceration rate and you have another. So they've tried to be as even-handed across the board. But what I think one of the biggest sort of challenges is, I mean, if you were to, Marik Kaminsky, for example, has written a sort of like ethnographic anthropology of his life experience in Polish prisons in the late 1980s. Well, Polish prison is very, very different from an American prison. Polish prison is a big room filled with, like, middle-aged men. American prison has, like, individuated cells, cellmates, some social space, solitary housing facilities. Like, it's a much more technologically sophisticated machine than is a prison in another country in another time. Many, many prisons in much of the third world look more like orphanages, abusive orphanages at that, than they would like a prison system. So the question becomes how we make meaningful comparisons. So recognizing this notion of wealth accumulation would require some sort of fixed set of institutionally similar countries. So this guy Soares pretty much only looks at OECD countries, right? In a similar vein as the, like I started our lecture with this comparison of the Solow model, the Solow model predicts convergence, meaning that a poor country will get capital because they'll have a higher marginal rate of return on that capital than a relatively wealthier country. If you've got 20 barrels of oil, and you live in the United States, that the marginal value of that oil is like somebody driving around, tooling around town. They're only going to pay a marginal price for that. If you send it to a relatively oil-poor country, let's imagine France has some oil shortage at this time, well, then they're going to get a higher marginal value out of those first units of oil, and so they'll be willing to pay a higher price for them. So that's what's going to be the incentive to send your oil abroad. Now, why don't we see this happen with capital from the United States to Bangladesh, for example? Well, the thing that you need most in order to facilitate that trade, the institutions, private property rights, a sound rule of law, a contract system, a monetary system, etc., are lacking in Bangladesh, so you're never going to see the capital accumulation there. You're never going to see capital flows through direct investment from the United States to Bangladesh. Well, a sort of similar logic in comparing apples to apples at the prison context is probably called for. So this guy Soares, he just looks at like relatively similar countries with similar criminal legal codes, with similar criminal justice technologies in place, and then says, okay, well, what's the relationship between economic freedom or prosperity on the one hand, and crime or incarceration? And he notices that there's a sort of relationship that we would expect, that as people are wealthier and as people are freer, that there's less crime. It's not a huge correlation, but it's relatively good. Opposite correlation holds when you look at the whole set. When you look at all the countries in the world, there is a spurious correlation or a questionable correlation between economic freedom on the one hand and mass incarceration on the other. Ezra Klein has written that up pretty interestingly. Again, I think that's sort of the major concern I have with the sociological perspective, is that they're really trying to treat capitalism like the boogeyman in driving this trend. But I just read The Economist just yesterday. We can't really trust wealth accumulation. I mean, in the Roaring Twenties, given by the graph, American homicide rates rose. It fell during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Does mean we cannot use capital accumulation? Okay, so it's not just capital accumulation that's the topic here. There's lots of things. A lot of people have a poverty model of crime, that poor people commit crimes because they are in dire straits, so on and so forth. A lot of the first models of crime and punishment were business cycle models. That the thought was that during a bust, there were criminal spikes because there was a systematic purveyance of poverty. And so anything which mitigated business cycles was perceived as simultaneously mitigating the effects of crime. None of that, I think, holds water according to sort of today's statistical techniques. But in fact, this is a basic sort of application of the substitution versus income effect. In other words, in today's recession, crime rates have dropped, in large part because people are too busy out looking for a job, right? There's sort of alternative things that might occupy time so much that would dissipate the effects of the notion that idle hands are the devil's plaything. Has there been any work done on whether technological changes have changed crime designations? possibly a drop in one type of crime would herald a rise in a new but similar and or different type. I'm thinking specifically of the internet. Well, I mean, with the rise of the internet is obviously an opportunity for internet-based crime. However, what the new technology usually brings is also the techniques and capacity to resolve that crime. So for example, Ed Stringham has a great paper in a collected volume on cybercrime specifically, that was published in Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy. Stringham points out that of the massive amount of international internet orders, something like 90% of them are fraudulent. Okay, so either you're sending money abroad or you're shipping goods abroad and the order came through on the internet. 90% of the orders that happen according to that are trying to defraud you. They're trying to get your money and not give you services, trying to get you services and not give you money. Yet something like 98% of that 90% is preliminary, like ruled out, like caught by digital filters and sort of fraud prevention software. In other words, the private market has solved the lion's head share of cybercrime without without government. So I don't think that there's long run data to support the notion that new technologies necessarily have a lasting effect on increased crime rate. And in fact, I mean, so again, like car stereo theft was endemic in the 1980s. I can't really name a single one of my friends who's had their car stereo stolen in recent years, and not because there's a car stereo theft task force, but rather simply because auto manufacturers started to design them so that they would be resilient to theft. What comes to my mind also in reading your question is the adaptive nature of the criminal population. So what my responses thus far have emphasized is the adaptive nature of entrepreneurship to resolve the cost of crime. On the other hand, you have adaptive criminals. So what comes to my mind is the meth trade. Since the 1980s, the United States has launched a war on drugs. And in doing so, cocaine has largely declined. So a lot of people have argued that our 90s crime decline is in lockstep with real lowered preferences in using cocaine. As surprising as that might be to hear, in a variety of survey evidence, it suggests that people don't do cocaine in various different forms as much as they did in the 1980s. Stephen Levitt also has work on this. And this makes some sense. Cocaine was relatively new on the scenes, especially crack. It takes some learning curve to figure out what the sort of real effects of those substances are before people start to say, okay, well, this is a very dangerous substance and I know well enough to stay away from it. But in conjunction with the war on drugs, what we've seen is a more entrepreneurial model of drug production. So whereas cocaine and opiates have to go through international distribution in order to get to the United States, we've seen a significant increase in domestic marijuana production as well as domestic methamphetamine production. Methamphetamine is a much more sort of entrepreneurial production process than is, say, cocaine or morphine production. I mean, it's sort of like decentralized. There aren't like kingpin sellers and dealers. They're more like local outfits. And the ability of the criminal justice system to crack down on meth is nearly insignificant. Like they're not really putting a significant dent in the meth trade or meth practices. Laura, does that answer your question? Make sense? Not paying attention. Well, that means, unless anyone has particular, yes, I was just wondering that the designations we have. Hold on. We are about at the hour and a half mark. I am bringing up the reading list just now so that we can know where we will be at for next week. So next week, what I plan to talk about is current sociological theories of crime and punishment. So made for a more physical world, violent property, etc., versus are changing into a more digital world, if that makes sense. Laura, that does make sense. I do, in fact, a large part of the work that I've done commenting on cybercrime is that to some extent, I think that as our more conventional and physiological world is excessively regulated and subjected to the risks of crime, we almost sort of retreat to the internet. And the internet is an interesting place to investigate the potentials for social order, in large part because the costs of social disorder are muted by nature of internet. Like, you can't get raped on the internet, like, in a real logistic sense. You can't get, like, bludgeoned. And so the stakes are very different, which it affords you an ability to be much more rude, but it also attracts a certain type of social interaction and trade set that that needs that sort of environment. So again, next week we'll be meeting to discuss predominantly sociological perspectives on these facts. So now that we've all sort of like seen and share and have a common understanding as to what the facts and realities of the criminal justice system are, we'll be surveying the sociological interpretations of those facts. Danny, I'm just waiting for you as to how we normally go about concluding. Great first lecture. Looking forward to the remainder of the course. Thanks, Matthew. William Stallings. Thanks. Welcome. Hope everyone had a good time. I'm sort of new to the notion of talking and not getting immediate feedback, but hopefully the online lectures will go more seamlessly in the future, and I'm really glad that you guys all signed up. You can select my name. Normally you can go to the file menu and select end, but today, select my name. First, stop the recording. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.